and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Sarawak's electoral borders are due for redrawing soon, as is Sabah, set to expire in 2025 and 2026 for Peninsula Malaysia. Now, ahead of the delineation exercise, it's worth examining some best practices on boundary delimitation and the potential for improvement in Malaysia. Adi Aman is a senior program manager at the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, better known as International IDEA. Adi, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. International IDEA recently jointly organized a roundtable discussion on boundary delimitation and malapportionment, so countries could kind of get together and share their experiences and the lessons that they've learned respectively. I'm wondering if you could begin our conversation today by telling us what were the most pressing concerns that emerged during these discussions, and what would you say were the main takeaways from that roundtable discussion?
Yeah, it's a rare opportunity that countries get together and talk about this subject, because for some reason, maybe certain quarters want this subject not to be discussed much because of certain vested interests. But this is what International IDEA does. We promote discussion and discourse in various countries, and oftentimes we organize these regional roundtables to provide a platform for discussion. And these countries, apparently when we exchange notes, they do share some common concerns. And what made us happy is that everyone in the room had common ideas of how they can be rectified as well. And that's why we came out with a declaration of principles.
Right. Okay, so when you look at the Malaysian context, are the apportionment of Malaysia's constitutional boundaries, is the apportionment of Malaysia's constitutions and boundary limitations, are these processes all in line with international norms?
Yes and no. The yes part is that there is a public consultation process in Malaysia where the public are able to submit their views on the existing boundaries. But what's lacking is that the process is just a formality, that the boundary commission or the boundary authority doesn't ultimately explain the reasons for their decisions, and also there are some states that are left out in the process, thereby malapportionment, which is the disparity of value of the number, the disparity of number of votes, number of voters in a constituency compared to other constituencies, is quite large. And that causes malapportionment, and that exists in Malaysia. And what's also important to note is that in Malaysia, it is the legislature that has the final say. This is an issue because the boundaries of constituencies they have the most vested interest in these boundaries. So you need to have a more independent boundary authority that have the final say. In other countries, the legislatures do have a role, but it's more of a rubber stamping role, that whatever the boundary authority proposes, they then just adopt into law.
Right. Without so you're talking about the one person, one value, one vote, one value principle. And I'm just wondering, in this age of big data and, you know, open data, is there a role that technology can play in upholding this principle and contributing to a more fair and accurate boundary drawing?
Yeah. Well, when we think of boundaries, we immediately think of maps, And with maps nowadays, we're so used to digital maps, and therefore technology can play a role in that. And secondly, when you're delimiting boundaries, you use mathematical numerical criteria. There are a formula that needs to be crunched, and machines can help do that. And this is why International IDEA and its partner Perludem have created an application called the Electoral Redistricting App, or ERA, to assist researchers and also civil society advocates to draw boundaries of their own. But so yes, technology is crucial.
So you mentioned a bit earlier that sometimes vested interests may make it difficult to change an existing system. Are there countries, Adi, that have been successful in either rectifying malapportionment or preventing it from happening? And what can Malaysia learn from their experience?
Yeah, it so happens that the country I live in currently, Australia, has overcome that, where in the mid-80s, they have made the process and the criteria, the parameters so tight and very much mathematical and numerical that it has been able to fend off any political considerations, political arguments, even social communities of interest debates surrounding boundary delimitation. And that has helped made the outcome of the boundary delimitation process more equitable. Plus, it is conducted by an independent, impartial, and professional boundary delimitation authority, which involves the Electoral Commission still, but it is joined by the country's chief statistician, and also a retired judge as the head of the Boundaries Commission. So Malaysia can learn from this process. I know Malaysia is quite a heterogeneous country, and people tend to want to think in those terms. But at the end of the day, this is a mathematical exercise. It should be a mathematical exercise because the ultimate goal is to get equitable size of constituencies.
Adi, thank you so much for joining me on the show and sharing those insights. Appreciate your time. Adi Aman from International IDEA there. We're going to take a very quick break here and consider this. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. We're discussing best practices on boundary delimitation and the potential for improvement in Malaysia. Joining me now is Danish Prakash Chako, who is director of the electoral reform group Pindad Malaysia. Danish, thank you for being on the show with me today. Now, Sarawak's election borders will soon be due for redrawing. I'm wondering whether you could begin our conversation by maybe describing the existing apportionment of the constituencies in Sarawak. How has it affected democratic representation of the people of Sarawak?
Thank you for inviting me to discuss a very important topic. The current situation in Sarawak is we have 31 parliamentary seats and 82 DUN seats, that is the State Legislative Assembly. So the current apportionment and the delineated boundaries were set out in 2015. What we have currently is a situation where one of the DUN seats in Miri called Senadin has close to 70,000 voters. And then one of the rural seats called Gedong, which is very close to Kuching area, is around 10,000 voters. What it means in simple sense, a voter, irrespective of their background in DUN Senadin, has a voting power 1/6 of DUN Gedong. And DUN Gedong, in area-wise, isn't very big. Because one of the things our constitution allows, the EC to part ways from the equality principle if a rural constituency a difficulty in reaching electors where a weightage of area could be given, right? But for Dun Gedong was an exception. It actually has far less voters than the interior dunes that is found in the Kapit and Hulu Rajang area. So this is what we have, the problem that we have in Sarawak. The gross inequality of voting power between the urban and the rural, and sometimes between some of the rural areas.
Okay, so I know that Tindak Malaysia has launched a website. So you're actually suggesting the different ways in which EC, the Election Commission, can draw an electoral map with where the number of voters for each of Sarawak's federal and state constituencies is within what is fair apportionment. Tell me what fair apportionment looks like for Sarawak.
Okay, this is a very important question because our constitution does not actually put an upper limit and lower limit for constituency electorate size. It gives the room for interpretation for our election commission. So historically, it allowed the election commission to create such seats that I mentioned, like Senadin having too many voters and Gedong having too little voters. Now, within this framework, here lies a great opportunity for our election commission to set an upper limit and lower limit. What they need to understand is Sarawak has 31 parliamentary seats and 82 dun seats. Okay, that means equalization, meaning all constituencies should have approximately equal number of voters, only can be done for all parliamentary seats or all dun seats. You can't do a concurrent equalization. If you want concurrent equalization, you do the principle of simple multiple. That means Sarawak dun count should be 93. But let's talk about the current situation. We have 82. So what we are telling EC is let's focus at equalizing the constituencies at the dun level, and this in turn will reduce the gross inequality at the parliamentary level. How should we do that? Okay, so we get the total number of electors divided by 82 for Sarawak, and you get a number, let's say around 20,000 plus. Okay, in reality, you are not going to have all constituency going to be having the exact average. So we create a deviation limit. For Sarawak, because of its vast geographical spaces, and more importantly, weaknesses in the physical and communication infrastructure, we give a deviation of plus or minus 20% for the dun constituencies. And that's what our proposal aims to do so.
So, Danish, can I ask you, earlier I spoke to Adi Aman of International Idea, and he talked about the Australia experience, where it's a very strict mathematical calculation when it comes to drawing boundaries. We know that there can be vested interests when it comes to and political motivations when it comes to redrawing electoral boundaries. How do we ensure that the process is transparent and accountable?
One of the purposes of this whole Sarawak redelineation portal that we have launched is to actually to tell EC there is a way to communicate information in such a way that a group of 100 voters or more, local authorities or state government, is able to make sense of their proposed recommendation. Historically, from our experience of the Sarawak 2015 redelineation exercise, they only have provided, that time was two, or Peninsular Malaysia was three PDFs, okay? PDFs such that all the voters could download, that's for sure. But let's be very clear. We only have a 30 days window when the proposed recommendation is issued, especially through that PDF. Within that period, you're expected to download, convert the file, analyze, determine whether you want to object or support, gather 100 voters or more who are of the affected constituency, which is a dynamic of its own. Then bring all those names together, bring your views, the representation view, whether you object or you support or both, do it everything, submit it to the EC at the end of the 30 days. Okay. Strictly speaking, within using the PDFs, 30 days is not enough. So this is why we have decided to launch this portal early and show EC. There is a way. Show interactive maps. Leverage the technologies that we have so that the voter knows where the constituency have shifted, and let the voters, the local authority or state government, determine whether what the response should be. And then we also have shown there are files that a person can download. And for this moment, I'm just giving you comma separated value files, CSV files, where anyone can analyze it within a week.
Dennis, can I ask you, so this is what you would like the EC to focus on, but what can citizens and the media do to actively participate in monitoring and advocating for fair delineation?
As a matter of fact, because the 8 years have lapsed from the Sarawak redelineation exercise this year, August, we have decided to launch this website also for that purpose. We are actually gathering views from especially voters from Sarawak to assess whether our proposal makes sense. And this is to actually to prepare them for that 30 days. And for us, we don't want you to just assess the proposal and suggest how to fix the boundaries. I'm not just interested in that. I want you to express interest to be either a person who object or who support the redelineation. Okay, it's subject to the situation, right? But the point is, I need to start collecting names now. And I'm appealing right now to all of you, especially those voters in Sarawak. When you visit our website, don't just view it and study it. There's one section for you to fill up and express yourself as being one of the group of 100 voters who can shape the views on the coming redelineation.
Dinesh, thank you so much for being on the show with me. Dinesh Prakash Chakur from Tindak Malaysia. We're going to take another very quick break on Consider This. Stay with us. We'll be back with more. Hello, I'm Melissa Idris. Thanks so much for staying with me on Consider This as we continue our discussion about the best practices on boundary delimitation and the potential for improvement in Malaysia. Joining me now is political scientist Professor Wong Chin Huat. He's the Deputy Head of Strategy for the Asia Headquarters of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network at Tsinghua University. Chin Huat, good to have you back on the show. Can we talk about gerrymandering? And maybe you can start by giving us some of the key indicators or signs of gerrymandering. What do we need to know about the impact of gerrymandering? Maybe you can give us a specific example here in Malaysia.
Thanks, Lisa, for having me. Now, gerrymandering is a way that politicians want to manipulate the electoral system. So instead of you choosing who to be your representative, they choose who amongst the electorate that can ensure their election. So this is subverting democracy. It is done by two common ways. One is to break up their opponent constituency. So if their opponents have a 60% support, what would they do is to split some of their voters to another constituency. So therefore, they're probably just 40%, and no matter how hard they work, they'll never get a chance to win. That's called cracking. Now, where does all these excluded constituents or voters go, they would put them together in a seat where their opponents are so strong, but they're basically winning less seats than they should deserve. This is called packing. Imagine a can of sardine fishes. So that's the situation we are in. How do we know that gerrymandering happened? It normally happened in, you can tell it from two ways. One is that the shape looks very awkward, not compact, and it's not justified because there's some natural infrastructure boundary. And in Malaysia, the easiest thing to know is that when a constituency cut across many municipalities, the worst that we have is Sungai Buloh. It started from Majlis Perbandaran Selayang, then into Majlis Bandaraya Petaling Jaya, then Majlis Bandaraya Shah Alam, then Majlis Daerah Kuala Selangor. And you have even state seats like Batu Tiga that cut across three municipalities, Subang Jaya, Shah Alam, and Klang. And the other way to know is that after election, the boundary changed so that one party have a better chance to win.
Okay, so you provided some insight into the political motivations and the interests that the vested interests that drive gerrymandering. We see the persistence of it. What safeguards are there against it? Are there reforms that can be implemented to prevent gerrymandering from happening or to correct the gerrymandering that already has happened?
If our election commission is honest and abiding by what our federal constitutions require, then we should actually be able to avoid gerrymandering, because Section 2D of the 13th schedule of our federal constitution requires preservation of local ties, maintenance of local ties in drawing the boundary. And it requires the avoidance of inconveniences to the residents. Now, previous election commission has not done that. What we can do to make sure this is right, the parliament can actually pass an act to complement the 13th schedule so that you spell out clearly what needs to be done, what cannot be done. For example, a state constituency cannot cross the boundary of a municipal authority. For example, you cannot carve out local community. For example, you and your neighbor live in the same neighborhood, but then you belong to different constituency. Things like this can be done easily.
Okay, but does it go beyond processes, Chinhua? Should we be looking at something more structural? Our electoral system, the way we vote, could maybe an alternative electoral system promote fairer representation, maybe mitigate the disproportionality and reduce gerrymandering?
Melissa, you're spot on. Unlike male apportionment, different signs of constituency that you can easily fake by setting as a band on the deviation from the average, gerrymandering is something very subjective. It's very hard for us to fake through drawing the boundary, because somehow some parties may still get advantage. So the solution is that we should actually go for proportional representation. Now, by saying that, I'm not suggesting that we throw out the first past the post that we have used for seven decades. What I'm suggesting is that we can actually introduce party list seats alongside first past the post. So, for example, for every state, other than having individual parliamentary constituency, we can have the entire state as a constituency. Let's say Selangor, you have 22 parliamentary constituency, but Selangor can itself be a big constituency to give 10 or 15 seats. Then what happened? Then all these 10 or 15 seats would be allocated to the parties based on the percentage they get. Now, the votes here is not the same votes. We don't count the same votes twice. What we can do is to allow people to have a second ballot, directly choose which party you want to support. Then we count on that. And that
please continue. Yeah, sorry.
And that can bring a lot of benefits other than correcting or mitigating disproportionality. It can also help at least in two ways. Three ways. One, mitigate party hopping, because you can directly vote for the party. And then, so if someone on the party list, an MP on the party list, jumped into the party, that seat will be replaced by another candidate, the next available candidate on the same list. And you don't have to go through by-election, which sometimes may actually help the party hopper. Second, we can introduce gender and other demographic quota. You can decide and say on the list, every one out of two or three has to be a woman, has to be someone below 30, has to be someone from Orang Asli or some tiny minorities. You can put those criteria in. Third thing, it can help us in political financing. If you have a direct vote to go for all these parties, then it's very easy for the country to decide and say, how many percents of public funding should go to the party? So a popular party can then get more money from the country. We do not have public funding for political party yet, but this would help. And then every vote you cast would not be wasted, because as long as your party passes the threshold, even if the party you support doesn't get a seat, the party may be able to claim some money for its future development. And on top of that, It helped the parties to overcome the problems of transferability. So two parties that may not be able to pull their votes together, they can campaign individually after elections, then only they come together. So it's many benefits with one little innovation.
Thank you so much, Chin-Hua, for sharing those insights with us. That was political scientist Professor Wong Chin-Hua wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.